the pace of advancement is going to accelerate day over day. Things are moving. We're sort of at the knee of a curve. And what we'll see 5 years from now will be substantially more transformative than what took 10 years or 20 years or 50 years prior to that point.
Welcome to the Redox Podcast. I'm your host, Nico Skibaski, co-founder and president of Redox, where we are on a mission to make healthcare data useful and in turn enable the frictionless adoption of technology in healthcare. The Redox Podcast explores the intersection between healthcare and technology. How is tech making a difference? What are the barriers to adoption and how are they being overcome? We talk to some of our industry's brightest minds, up-and-coming technologists, and health tech legends that have paved the way for what's to come. One thing is certain, healthcare will change dramatically over the coming years. My hope is that you'll leave these conversations with a bit more context, along with a jolt of optimism to continue working for a better healthcare. With that in mind, I welcome you to the Redox Podcast. We are delighted today to be joined by Dr. Bill Hansen, the Chief Medical Information Officer and Vice President at Penn Medicine. He's also a professor of anesthesiology and critical care at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania. His distinguished career spans more than 30 years, and he's constantly been a proponent of using technology to improve patient care. Bill, it's great to have you on the show. Thank you for joining us. Back in 2008, more than a decade ago now, you published a book called The Edge of Medicine, The Technology That Will Change Our Lives. Since it was published, have things turned out the way you expected? What are the biggest surprises, better or for worse?
Well, I would say that some of the things that I talked about in the book have definitely progressed with advances in some of the life-saving therapies that we talked about, like proton therapy and the use of things like hypothermia in treatment. We're certainly seeing rapid evolution in the technological side of what we do with medicine, pushed or pulled in some ways by the widespread adoption of electronic medical records, as you mentioned. And that has been transformative in a lot of ways because we have the EMR, we have both structured and unstructured text available to describe patients. The EMRs are integrated increasingly with devices at the bedside or in the operating room. And there is better connections for patients who travel from one hospital to another or one geographic location to another. So I think a lot of things have progressed quickly. I think some folks would argue that the EMRs have not been as helpful to providers or patients as the people who paid the money for adoption of the EMRs expected. So we've seen some areas where interoperability of medical information just hasn't progressed as rapidly as people would have hoped.
Let's dive in on that a bit. So the dream of the electronic health record was to deliver more efficiency gains in the healthcare system, automate administration, increase data analysis. And as you mentioned, some people would say that that dream of the EHR went awry. The government provided about $30 billion of subsidies poured into the industry to help adopt electronic health records through this meaningful use program. Where would you say we went wrong, and what steps do we have to take to kind of overcome that?
Well, I would say that we need to acknowledge the fact that we went from a period of time when there was spotty adoption of electronic records, and they were typically best of breed and focused on different highly specialized environments like the operating room where you might have an anesthesia EMR, or the emergency room where you might have an emergency room EMR, to widespread adoption of enterprise-wide electronic medical records. And I would say that this is both a pro and a con in a sense. The process has favored a limited number of vendors who were sort of the winners of the EMR wars, and many of the best of breed EMRs have or are in the process of falling by the wayside. So I think we were successful in having doctors and hospitals adopt electronic records. What I think we've not yet succeeded in is in a couple of things that are really important. The first thing is the degree to which these EMRs make it easier for providers to do their work. You know, the documentation, the analysis of patient information, the comprehensive understanding of what's happening with a patient. I think there are user interface challenges, so that many doctors would say, doctors and other providers, that they are feeding the EMR, but it's not regurgitating the information they need in the way that they need it. And the other thing I think that was expected to be an outcome of the adoption of electronic medical records is the greater portability of patient information as patients move from hospital to hospital or geographic location to geographic location. Things like health information exchanges have worked well in some geographic areas and not so much in others. There are proprietary networks that allow for the exchange of information within a single EMR across locations, but not necessarily across EMRs. And frankly, many private physicians or small ambulatory patient groups are not attached to the enterprise EMRs at the hospitals that they admit to.
So yeah, that brings up a great point. Almost a year ago now, the ONC and CMS released some new interoperability rules, or proposed rules, I should say, because the industry is anxiously awaiting the final rules to come out. But what do you think about these latest efforts around data blocking and TEFCA, as it refers to, you know, some of the HIEs out there? Is that kind of fixing the mistakes that were made for meaningful use, or I should say the things that were left to be completed? Or where do you see that kind of pushing the industry?
Well, I think there's no doubt that that is a well-intentioned initiative by the ONC. And as of yet, the ONC has not done a lot in the way of enforcement and the application of penalties. So people are in this world where they realize that these proposed penalties for information blocking will likely come into effect, but they haven't yet seen them. I actually had an opportunity to spend some time with an official from CMS and the ONC last week, and it's clear that they're very bent on further clarifying what they mean by information blocking and who might be penalized for it. I mean, when you think about information blocking, that's something that might be done by a health system. It might be done by a vendor. And it's not clear at this point who's going to be the receiving end of penalties, or where they're going to try to exercise the tools that they have to spur the adoption of better interoperability techniques and methods.
Yeah, that's always something that has been a head scratcher for me. A lot of health systems actually view their patient data as a strategic asset that they own. Yet, you know, as individual providers, I think we would all agree that the data should follow the patient. How do we disrupt this way of doing business where kind of the incentives are aligned for, you know, to hold on to these assets, but the right thing to do for patients is really to ensure that everyone has the data necessary to treat patients correctly?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very interesting dynamic there. I think most physicians and most health systems are comfortable with the idea of emancipating an individual patient's data as they move from one location to another. So on a patient-by-patient basis, it's pretty clear that it's advantageous to a patient to have information about their medications, their diagnoses, diagnostic procedures that have been done to them, like, you know, x-rays or procedural information from surgery, things that are critical to go with the patient as they move from provider to provider. I think that there is definitely a sense that the bulk transfer of aggregates of patient information is viewed as more of an asset. And frankly, it's not just by the healthcare provider or the system. I think this is also something that's felt by vendors and, you know, obviously researchers as well, is that you have an aggregate of population of patients, a disease-specific population of patients. There are advantages in having that information and characterizing a group of, say, diabetics or hypertensive patients. But then the bulk movement of large collections of patient information does have that label of being a business asset in some cases.
Yeah, that's a great distinction. You know, on a patient-by-patient basis, of course, the data should move. But from a bulk perspective, that is really kind of an asset to the organization. Which brings up, a few years ago, CIO Magazine featured Penn Medicine's work in using big data to create new care pathways. So actually using these big data tools to analyze data. And as you pointed out in that story, the biggest challenges for Penn Medicine and really everyone when it comes to big data projects is the lack of interoperability among EMRs, you know, actually getting the data out amongst a large population so you can actually crunch that data. There's so much good to be had really with big data techniques. What do you think it will take to get us to the point where that data is free to flow so analyses like this could be completed at a larger scale?
So there's a couple ways to think about this. One is that the data is free to flow, and either through penalties or incentives or appropriately structured relationships between the parties involved in some of these research efforts, it could be that the data flows. There's also sort of a growing view that there may be techniques where the research can come to the data in a federated database or something where there are strict privacy controls and the data itself doesn't need to flow, but the research algorithm or research process can come to the individual databases and do the same work without forcing the data holder to transfer the data, if you will.
Interesting. So you're talking about techniques where you could potentially run an algorithm or, you know, or regression or some sort of data analysis on data, but not actually see the data, you know, just get the outputs, the coefficients.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
Have you done that at Penn Medicine? Is that something that you've worked with other organizations?
We've done some early work in that area. We certainly had conversations both with partner academic institutions as well as with, there are some vendors that kind of worked on this problem in other industries, this idea that a data holder might not be willing to exchange data or lose control of the data, but is interested in large scale data analysis or predictive analytic efforts. So yes, we've done some work in this space and we're highly attentive to the potential for techniques that respect the competing interests of some of these challenges.
So going back to something you said earlier, electronic health records have been, well, I should say there's a lot of attention in the media lately paid to the headaches that are created by EHRs for providers, contributing to clinician burnout, some of these large challenges with efficiency that we kind of see across the industry right now. But I'd like to spend a moment approaching it from really a more positive angle based on something you told Information Week a couple years ago. You said that the upcoming generation of doctors are eager to embrace the clinical opportunities embedded in the EHR. Medical students and residents see models that should be explored. You also said that it's not surprising that the younger people in training are the ones with ideas about how to take advantage of the data to improve care. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, I'd like to avoid making this the youth versus the aged, because there are certainly people in my organization, people with whom I work, who are in the latter stages of their career and very sophisticated about the use of data and the use of the EMR. But we're at a point right now where you can sort of roughly segregate or divide the population of providers into an older generation that grew up using paper documentation, grew up for a significant portion of their lives in an era when there was no email, there was no internet, there were no browsers, there weren't mobile phones, and understood a way of providing medical care that was largely paper-centric and where the information you might get about a patient or a disease was something you'd have to go look up in a library. The other half of the provider population, if you will, and again, this is sort of a rough divide, grew up with internet, with technology. They absorbed it in their classrooms, in grade school, elementary school, in high school, and certainly in college, and never used a typewriter or frankly, never had to go find a book in a library because the libraries were online. So the younger generation of folks coming through medical school now, they don't need to be educated as to how to work with electronic technology. That's the way they've always worked. So they have, you know, a better sense of what one can do with large collections of data. An analog for the medical predictive analytics is might be Amazon algorithms or Apple algorithms for you like these songs or these books or what have you, and let me algorithm offer you another one like that. The same way that you might say, this set of sepsis patients or this set of readmitted patients look the same. And if I compare a new unknown patient to that data set, are they like or different from that population? So the younger generation has much better sense of how to get data in and out of machines and then how to use data in aggregates for the kind of work that we do in medicine.
Obviously, you're of that generation. You know, I imagine when you started practicing medicine, you were on paper. And obviously, you've made that transition to really the forefront of technology and how it could and should be used in healthcare. How did you navigate that personally? And what challenges did you see there versus what other providers are undergoing?
You navigated that nicely. You didn't say you're one of the older generation. But I am. And, I grew up, as it happens, for just personal interest. I used computers in high school. I bought one of the early personal computers, the IBM PC, when I was a resident. I did my residency at Stanford, which had some early computer technology and where we would look up labs, for example. And then as I entered into my career as an anesthesiologist and intensivist, I worked in and around machinery that was computer ready and actually did some work taking physiologic patient data directly from some of the bedside and OR side monitors. So I happened to be doing research in an area where I was exposed to the power of electronic data. And then slowly around me, the use of these same technologies for record keeping and then communication across networks grew because the PCs at the very beginning of time were standalones, and the networking is obviously a tremendous leveraging technology for what an individual computing device can do. And then I got involved in telemedicine early, doing ICU telemedicine. And when the time came that the health system realized that they needed to have a technologically savvy physician to work as sort of the interface between the information technology community and the medical technology, they asked me to take on that role. And that's sort of how I got here.
As long as I've been in healthcare, which is substantially shorter than you, like the last decade or so, there has been this CMIO role, which is that kind of translator between the docs and the technologists. Is that a newer role in the industry, or like how did that come about, and how do you see yourself straddling those two?
It is definitely a newer role. I would say at this point, the idea of the CMIO has been around in most organizations for about a decade. When I started in this role, there were things like CMIO boot camps. And people were trying to define what that individual looked like, what kind of training was required to take on that role, and what are the roles that a CMIO might get involved in. So I would say prior to that point, there were definitely physician and nursing folks who had an interest in technology and might have worked with the information technology community, but not really at a leadership level. And I think most CMIOs at this point are either at the executive level or in the executive suites of large medical systems. And with every passing day, there's sort of a new area in which the CMIO might be working. There's things like telemedicine, mobile health, predictive analytics. All of those things depend on having an electronic foundation, which is the EMR. So, job one 10 years ago was deploy and install the EMR as painlessly and as efficiently as possible. And then once that foundation was laid, you have the opportunity to layer in other technologies on top of that base.
I'd love to hear about some examples from Penn Medicine that you've put on top of that foundation of the EMR. Of course, Penn Medicine is a highly regarded healthcare organization. It's always on that U.S. News and World Report list of top hospitals. Yeah, what examples do you have? I've read about things like Penn Signals, which is doing real-time analysis, predictive analysis for heart failure patients. There's also the Penn Center for Connected Care from a telemedicine perspective. Can you dive into one of those examples and kind of share what the technology is doing and how it's benefiting patients?
So telemedicine, really, if you think about it from the word roots, tele is far and medicine is medicine. So the idea of communicating medically important information over distance has been around for centuries. And actually, ships in the plague era would fly a flag indicating that they had a plague patient on board and then be quarantined for a period of time before the ship would be allowed into port. In the early part of the 20th century, folks recognized that the telephone and the telegraph might be used for telemedicine, but it's really been with the advent of electronic medical records with networked locations that we've been able to think about how to really extend the reach of the provider from their physically proximate environment to over distances that might be across a hospital, it might be across a county, it might actually be across the ocean. What we've done here is we've sort of segregated telemedicine into two broad categories. One is the Penn Center for Connected Care, which you mentioned, and that's where it makes sense to have a staffed central location, the hub, where there are providers that might be doctors, nurses, nurse practitioners, working in sort of a technology-enabled core with patients who might be in several different hospitals. So we do both tele-ICU, which I mentioned earlier. There's an intensive care team that's located in a central location looking at patients in four different hospitals at this point. They have connections to the bedside physiologic monitors. They have smart software which says, come look at the patient in bed 11. Their blood pressure is dropping. Their heart rate is going up, for example. So there are background tools that allow the providers to focus their attention on the sickest patients. We also run a virtual urgent care service out of that same location where 24 hours a day, somebody can call in and say, I'm not sure if I need to go to the emergency room or an urgent care clinic. I have the following set of symptoms. And in many cases, the providers can help with the diagnosis and care of that patient without ever having them go to an ER or an urgent care clinic, which is obviously very desirable in this era of just-in-time or immediate gratification that we all live in, where you can shop from your home or do banking from your home. The other half of the way we think about telemedicine is what we call network telemedicine. And this is more, not so much hub and spoke, this is more point-to-point, where a provider at our flagship academic hospital may interact with a transplant candidate or a patient at a geographically remote location in real time. It could be that it's a doctor to a patient, it could be a doc to a doc. It's helped us in any number of ways with things like post-op visits, dealing with patients in a way that doesn't force the patient to come to the provider, but the provider virtually can come to the patient. That broad separation of things has allowed us to move very quickly. And as I've mentioned, the EHR's capability as being the infrastructure that allows that information and the audiovisual stuff to flow has been very, very important. It's a combination of technology has come along and then people begin to see where these applications make most sense.
I love this concept of patients expect the modern consumer experience that they get from ordering pizza or buying things online, that they kind of expect that in healthcare, and telemedicine is one of the ways that we can try to help bring that modern experience to patients as consumers. We talk a lot about this rise of consumerism in healthcare and new applications on the market, and patient portals. Of course, UPenn has the MyPenn Medicine app that allows patients to communicate with providers and look at their medical records and their med lists and things like that. I'd love to just hear more about your thoughts on consumerism and how patients are catching on to these sorts of tools.
Yeah, again, you know, we're seeing an evolution. We're not quite where some of the most technologically forward industries are at this point, but in many areas over the course of my adult lifespan, we've seen things go from being opaque to transparent for the consumer. So you can compare prices, or you have visibility as to the quality, or 100,000 people have rated a restaurant or a product and given it somewhere between 0 and 5 stars, that you have a sense of transparency about how to get the best product at the best price from the best location. We're not there yet with medicine, but I think we certainly at the leadership level in Penn Medicine and really across the organization feel that the best way to engage a patient in their care is to make them a partner to the process. So give them much more information about their diagnosis, about the results of their tests. We've actually opened up in the ambulatory setting our doctor's note. So the doctor sees the patient, writes up his or her thoughts in a note. The note's shared with the patient if they wish. The radiology results from that interaction are available for the patient. Patient has the ability to see what medications they're on. I mentioned to you earlier that when I was younger, patients would come in with index cards where they'd carefully written out their medications in legible or illegible handwriting, and the ink might or might not be faded or water stained. That was the only way they had to carry information around. Now, a lot of information is available through the MyPenn Medicine portal or other portals at other organizations. I think patients can be better partners in their care the more information they have available, and therefore more intelligent consumers of healthcare, because healthcare, unlike 20 years ago, has become increasingly expensive. Everybody's being exposed to the costs of medicine, and either through co-pays or health care savings accounts, et cetera. So more information we can give patients about how to consume healthcare thoughtfully and intelligently is in everybody's interest.
So with consumerism, the core idea is, yeah, let's give patients the ability to consume their healthcare data and try to help be a better partner in their own care, right? Make the decisions that make a lot of sense to them. And I've always had this conflict in my head between consumerism, which is very much a market-driven activity, you know, your typical market-based allocation of goods and resources, allowing the sovereign consumer to go and make choices on their own behalf because they're really the ones with incentives aligned there. I've always had a conflict with that idea and kind of this idea around value-based care, where essentially we're creating these economic models with health systems such that they are really looking at a patient holistically, right? Not only in the hospital, but let's also look at them in the outpatient setting, as well as, you know, the social determinants space, right? All the things that go into a person's health outside of the four walls of the healthcare organization. How do you think about that when we have patients which we want to enable to shop, enable to kind of make their own decisions, but at the same time, we're introducing this economic structure such that we really want to follow a patient, right? Look at them holistically, remote patient monitoring and the like, and really surround them with an entire continuum of care. Are those two things at odds, or are they really complementary to each other?
You know, that's a really interesting point you're making there. I think what you're talking about is with consumerism, the locus of control ideally rests with the patient. And with the value-based propositions that we've talked about, it's in the health system's interest to maintain the locus of control at the health system and to control as much of the patient's experience and expenditures from that perspective. Is that loosely characterized correct?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I don't think those things necessarily are at odds with one another, but they certainly could be. we know that if a patient has their healthcare in two or more systems, that their healthcare expenditures for a given condition are substantially higher than if they maintain their care in one system where all of the testing is coordinated, there's not duplicative testing or inefficient or duplicative information gathering and the like. So there's a rationale for trying to keep the experience as concentrated as possible in a single system where the system has visibility to everything that's going on. I think if the experience provided by that system is satisfactory or appealing to the patient, then everybody's interests are aligned. If the patient is seeing value by keeping their care in one system and that system provides them a better patient experience than going to multiple locations and having disorganized information, then the interests of the healthcare system and the patient are aligned and similar. If the patient finds that, you know, for whatever reason, in some cases it may be geographical, the patient is located far away from a provider that has a unique service that they can offer. So an example for us might be proton beam therapy, which is not available widely. Maybe the patient comes to a location like Penn Medicine for their proton beam therapy and then goes back to their local provider for their regular ordinary care. It's then sort of incumbent on their local care provider and Penn Medicine to make sure that the experience is as seamless as possible and that there's good information flow between those two locations because the patient is really sort of stuck with, you know, where they live.
One thing that comes up a lot when we start talking, going down these rabbit holes is the type of patient, right? Not all patients are the same, and certain types of patients may have better outcomes in certain situations where, yeah, they have a full sort of one healthcare organization managing all of their care versus others may be more engaged in their care or be in a different stage of their life where they can actually act more like a consumer and shop. So these don't necessarily need to be in conflict because a given patient might actually choose between them. And I think that's kind of what you were hitting on with certain patients may just come to the academic medical center for these types of highly specialized or acute sort of procedures and then go back into their care settings.
Yeah, exactly.
People talk about disruption in healthcare and where it's going to come from. I'd love to hear your thoughts on that. Does healthcare need to be disrupted? And do you think the academic medical centers as the leaders kind of from an innovation standpoint are going to be pushing that envelope or will it come from kind of outsiders or these new primary care models you see popping up all over the place?
Well, it's a large question. I think healthcare does need disruption. I mean, the rate of rise of healthcare as a percentage of GDP is frankly unsustainable. When healthcare starts to crowd out education and other budgetary priorities of the government, you're ending up making choices that are challenging. I would say that if you look at American healthcare, there are places where we do phenomenally well with challenging conditions and we're appropriately seen as the leader in healthcare innovation and care. But there are also a number of signals that we don't provide the greatest care for the greatest number of people compared to other developed countries, which have healthcare that's sophisticated, but not the same percentage of GDP. So I think there is a lot to disrupt in terms of healthcare administration, the payment for healthcare, the paradigms that are used for payment. As to where the innovation is going to come from, and I think we're in a really interesting era now. We're positioned so that we can support and sustain an innovation center and a nudge unit. A nudge unit is a unit that in the health system that looks at ways that we can help providers do what they want to do without making them more inefficient in the electronic medical record. There are innovation efforts that are available from within the academic medical center. We have the bright young medical students, nursing students. We have a large innovative employee workforce that other systems frankly can't afford at this point just because their margins are slimmer. So there is the opportunity for an academic medical center like Penn's to innovate from within. We're also looking to support or sustain interactions with startups that are bringing new ideas to medicine. And the best place to incubate those new ideas is oftentimes in an academic medical center. So we're in that case a participant or a partner in innovation. And frankly, I think that there are large, as we're all aware, large technology companies that have historically not been medically oriented that are beginning to turn their attention to medicine just because of the cost of medicine, but you know, inherent with the cost of the opportunities to be more efficient. So companies like Google, Microsoft, Apple, Amazon are all beginning to develop innovative approaches that are based on their skill sets. And Google does very well with pattern recognition, as we know, and is turning their pattern recognition techniques to look at images like x-ray images or dermatologic images or retinal images. Amazon understands how to interface they're probably the experts at consumerism. Apple brings healthcare platforms that might be centered on your mobile phone. I think that there are a variety of places from which innovation might come in this era. Certainly the Academic Medical Center is not the only one of them.
I think this brings a really great segue into the final question I wanted to ask you. So 2020 is right around the corner. You're about a decade out since your book, The Edge of Medicine. Well, that really highlighted a lot of the technological advancements that we were expected to see. So if you were writing a follow-up to that and looking ahead into this next decade of the 2020s and beyond, what changes would you look for there? And what are you most excited about as we look forward in healthcare?
Well, I mean, I'll talk first about the main subject of our conversation has revolved around electronic technology and patient care. And I think that there's huge opportunity for advances in predictive analytics and identifying the best population of patients to target your efforts on. In any large population of patients, there's going to be a top 10% where your efforts might best be focused on either improving their care or making their care more efficient. I think we're going to see telemedicine is exploding around us, and there are any number of ways in which we can use telemedicine to make the healthcare experience more efficient for patients and connect with patients in their homes where appropriate and move the locus of care from the hospital possibly to the patient's, you know, more familiar home environment. I think for the provider population where we've talked about burnout, I think providers have been frustrated by the experiences they've had in electronic records. And we're beginning to see the vendors, we're beginning to see governmental agencies, certainly provider organizations like mine, focused on how to make the experience for the provider in their workflow more satisfactory so that the EMR is not front and center as a cause of burnout. And then, of course, you know, there's areas outside of this kind of, you know, data technology that we're seeing cell-based therapies and genetic therapies that 10 years ago they held promise. Now we've actually got populations of patients where we're seeing effectively cures from what were once thought to be intractable cancers, or we're seeing people that are able to see where they've been blind all their lives through genetic interventions. So I think that there's a range of ways in which healthcare is going to advance. And my sense is that the pace of advancement is going to accelerate day over day, where things are moving. We're sort of at the knee of a curve. And what we'll see 5 years from now will be substantially more transformative than what took 10 years or 20 years or 50 years prior to that point.
Well, that's a great outlook. Thank you so much for taking the time with us this morning, and really appreciate getting to work with you and the folks over at Penn Medicine over the years as we've looked at some of these new innovations and helped kind of bring some of them to light. So obviously really appreciate you hopping on with us and taking the time, and I'm sure our audience will be able to learn a lot from this too. So thanks a lot, Bill.
Thanks, Nico. This was fun.
Hey everybody, it's Nico here. A couple more things. Just wanted to again give a super big thanks to Dr. Bill Hansen for joining us today on the Redox podcast. We hope that you'll subscribe wherever you find your podcasts, leave a review, let us know what you think, and join us next time when we'll be doing something a little bit differently. So I'll be joined by my colleagues Luke Bonney and James Lloyd. Of course, we started Redox together, and I figured that we'd occasionally get the crew together on the Redox podcast to talk about the industry, the company, anything else that seems worth discussing. Typically a good time chatting with those gents. And one last thing, wanted to let you know that if you'll be in San Francisco the week of January 13th, 2020, it'd be great to meet up. We're throwing our usual JPM Fiesta, so you can find details and how to reach out to us at www.redoxengine.com/JPM. Thanks for listening, and as a final reminder, we are all patients. Thank you.